Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Folly Coffee Podcast. If you haven't done so already, I ask that real quick here, you just pause, go ahead and subscribe to the podcast, and if you've liked any of the previous episodes or this episode, please give us that five-star rating. It helps us greatly. Thank you, and enjoy this episode. Hey, this is Rob. This is episode 96 of the Folly Coffee Podcast. Let's get it brewing. Back again on the Folly Coffee Podcast is the one, the only Joe Morocco, a.k.a. Roaster Joe.
It's my third time.
Except you're leaving us.
Yeah, I am. Not too far, though.
Yeah, so today's episode, well, one, I just wanted to get any episode in with you before you head down to Kansas City. But your new role you're taking on kind of inspired the thought of what this episode will be about. So this episode will be, let's go over your new role down in Kansas City. I said it right before we were on the mic, but, like, you've held every role in coffee. And this new role that you have, Jeff, after he heard about it, was like, that exists? He was like, can we do that someday? And then after that, the idea was just talking the future of specifically probably high-end coffee or coffee in general within the United States, because your new role kind of got me thinking about, like, oh, this is probably going to be the type of business we see happen regionally, potentially nationally. And so I guess we'll start with just, like, tell me all about the new role. I know you've already told me on the phone call you had. Well, first of all, I want to bring that up because this speaks to you more as a person than I think, like, any experience I've had. So you were at List & Beisler. Obviously, we're purchasing coffees from you at List & Beisler.
It's true.
And so you texted me and Jeff, like, hey, like, can we hop on a call? I need to tell you something. And I'm like, okay, is the shipment not coming? What else is happening here? I was like, this is a little odd. And then you get the call and you're like, hey, I just want to tell you that I am moving on from List & Beisler, and you told us about the new role, and you're like, I just feel bad. I don't want you to feel like I'm leaving you hanging out to dry. And both of us are like, wait, what? No, are you kidding me? This new role sounds incredible. So taking on this new opportunity while also the thoughtfulness you put into things is always something I've respected about you, and the thoughtfulness you put into not just what does this do for me, but hey, can I take care of the people I have been working with and making sure that the new person taking over at List & Beisler, that it's a smooth transition and that we're all taken care of. And so I really appreciate that. But tell me all about the new role. Unfortunately, it's down in Kansas City, so we no longer have Joe in our backyard here in the Twin Cities. But after hearing about the role, I go, this seems like an obvious decision in your career.
It's true. Yeah, and I want to start by saying leaving List & Beisler was probably the hardest decision I've made because everything was so great there. I was, you know, really working on some things that I was proud of and excited about, so there's no love lost there. Still a huge fan of them, and yeah, that was a tough day. But I definitely think that I'm moving into something that is more encompassing of my career so far and that I can shape in a lot of different ways. So I've been asked to be the VP of coffee sourcing and product development for a company called Fairwave Coffee Collective, which is a collective of specialty coffee companies. Right now, it consists of The Roastery in Kansas City, Messenger Coffee in Kansas City. And Messenger already had a couple of subsidiary cafes called The Filling Station, which is a few locations, and Black Dog, which is one location. So I am in charge of basically all of the coffee product.
I just came back from a wedding in Arkansas, and I'd been to Messenger before, but just, like, it was funny being there again, knowing that you were taking this role. And Messenger Coffee in Kansas City, if you haven't been there, their flagship location where the roastery is located, where the bakery is located, is one of the most beautiful spaces in the country. You've got rooftop patio. It's like three floors. The entire space is incredible. The coffees are amazing. And I wasn't even aware that, like, Roastery and Messenger were all part of one company now. And so to hear that you've got this opportunity to go in and manage the coffee sourcing and coffee products for this company was really, really intriguing. And tell me more, because you were telling me about it. It's kind of like their business model. So it's Fairwave is kind of the like the overall company and their kind of strategy within coffee and how they approach the, running their business and growing.
Yeah, so we are a collective, so it's not like a systematic buyout whenever we are partnering with another company. We are purchasing that company, but we are retaining that company's identity, the staff, if they want to stick around. We hope that they stick around. We're retaining the model, you know, all of the different aspects that created that business to begin with. So the identity, the functionality of the companies that are part of the collective are still very much intact. And, you know, to look at this time that we have been through, COVID in particular, a lot of companies out there have really suffered. And at first, whenever I'll just be super blunt and open as usual. At first, whenever I thought about joining this group, I thought, well, yeah, of course they're buying companies right now because companies are easy pickings. And that seems pretty, I don't know, it seemed a little mercenary. But as I've spoken, well, as I investigated that thought, I realized that I was very, very wrong. It's not a mercenary buyout. It's something that the companies can join, and there are things in place to where as these companies recover, the company is able to get, or the person that sold the company or the people that sold the company are able to get more funds in the future according to how the company recovers after COVID. So it really is a great opportunity for a company that has maybe reached a point where they're struggling to grow to that next level. You know, there are a lot of entrepreneurs out there that start a company and they get to a certain size where they're in charge of everything that that company is doing. And it's hard for them to really come to grips with what they need to do to take it to the next level. And so we can provide that opportunity. And from my perspective, from my, I guess, involvement, what I'm going to provide and working on providing is supporting the green coffee purchasing and the quality of the coffee throughout each one of those brands, regardless of what kind of roaster they have, regardless of what pre-existing relationships they have, holding those relationships, keeping them intact, and then refining the way that they flow, refining the efficiencies through the company. Another super cool thing is, you know, when a company becomes a part of the collective, the full-time employees automatically get healthcare. They automatically get a 401k. Generally, they'll get a boost in income. Those kinds of things are things that a lot of small businesses just can't offer, especially right now. So super rewarding, and I'm just jazzed about it. And I won't only be touching the coffee. I'll be touching the other beverages and products that we're serving as well, the canned beverages, you know, any kind of other products that we're developing through the system. So yeah, it's pretty daunting, but very exciting.
Yeah, because I think that's a pretty healthy first reaction to have when you hear of a company that's purchasing other small businesses or growing businesses and being like, okay, what's the why here? Like, why are they doing this? Is it because it's COVID and you can get really low valuations on businesses that are trying to get out and they've obviously are not doing it that way because they factor in COVID numbers and be able to get additional funds after the fact? And then you think of really large companies like Topo Chico is one I think of, that it used to be like this cult following brand and it's like, oh, it's independently owned. It's just crazy that it's this popular, and then it gets purchased and now you're seeing it being blasted everywhere. There's a hard seltzer Topo Chico, and those seem to be companies that are looking for short-term profitability. There's usually a lot of shareholders involved. There's external influences that we need to be profitable now, and buying companies that are strong brands that are growing at the moment or hot brands at the moment is a great way to do that if you're just concerned for short-term profitability. And then a lot of time you'll see those brands suffer long-term. I mean, we'll be talking probably a lot about the beer industry when we're talking the coffee industry because that's a lot how I think about a lot of things. But hearing what you were doing and what I'm sorry, I keep wanting to say Third Wave because of the water minerals, but Fairwave. And hearing what they're doing seems like such a benefit for the businesses, because you hear like venture I always get worried when I see companies that I love what they're doing take on a lot of venture capital, because you run into the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And when you get to a period of growth that your growth is outpacing your cash flow, so not your profitability, but like the actual cash you have in the bank, you're paying vendors, you're buying bigger orders for your, especially in coffee, you're buying large bulk green coffee.
Yep.
Meanwhile, you have to pay your vendors. And then the checks that are coming in now are the bills from 30 days ago, which are hopefully smaller than the invoices that are going to be in the future. And so it's, I think, really great businesses that are growing quickly all of a sudden find that need for funding. And venture capitalists seem to be, generally, they'll come in and be like, no, we love what you're doing. We want you to, we'll be real hands-off. Just keep doing what you're doing. Yep. Oh, but in 5 years, we need to make our money back.
Mm-hmm.
Versus this being a purchase is they're now invested into the long-term success of that company.
Yep.
And the reason they're buying it is because genuinely they love what that company is doing and see a long-term future there. And so it seems to me that a partnership with Fairwave or a purchase by Fairwave, whatever you want to call it, would take a lot of that pressure, like you were saying, that so many business owners just take on everything that they're doing for the company.
Yeah.
And then what they're really good at is just a small part of running that business. And this allows them to not only take care of their employees in a way, but free them up to do what they're best at. And I am not a paid sponsor, or I'm not a paid influencer of Fairwave, but yes. Legitimately, when Jeff heard this, he's like, "Wait, what's he doing?" He's like, "Which coffee companies is it?" He's like, "That's a thing." Like, I didn't know that existed, and that's what kind of sparked the I don't know if you call it spiral or just a train of thought that I had about not just with Folly, but the long term of coffee is like, what is this industry going to do? So first, congrats.
Thank you.
Much deserved. You're one of my favorite people in the industry. Like, your selflessness, your thoughtfulness does not go unheard. And on past episodes, you've probably heard that, like, you're so thoughtful and selfless that you've had to, like, check yourself to be like, hey, I'm draining myself because of this. But that's a good problem to have versus the opposite.
I'm turning real red right now.
Yeah, good thing we're audio only today. Mainly because it's so hot here that I'm sweating. And also, my camera is not working. So that too. But that got me thinking about, because what this reminded me of is what Fairwave is doing, is you see forms of this, obviously previously being in craft mm-hmm. beer. You saw this happening a lot in craft beer, and you see it now. And then I was talking with Barnaby yesterday, and we started talking a little bit about this topic, and I was like, this is really intriguing. The NCA report just came out on like coffee consumption in trends. And so that's kind of where I want to start this out. So I would say today here in, what is it? It's still June. Yeah, it's June.
Yep.
Of 2021, I would say what you have in the landscape of high-end roasters, you've got some major national players. I think your Intelligentsia, your Stumptown, Counterculture,
mm-hmm.
There's any others that you'd kind of put in that category at like nationally distributed specialty, like high-end?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I would include Pete's Coffee and Tea in that category, even though they're a little bit more dark roasted. The quality of the coffee that they buy is very high. I would also include Delano's in that conversation.
That's a good call.
Most of what they do is private labels, so you don't really know that you're drinking Delano's, but they're pretty widely distributed. There's definitely more out there for sure.
So you've got these national players being nationally distributed. They're on the front end of that third wave movement, Blue Bottle probably to a certain extent mm-hmm. on the cafe side. And then you're starting to see like some big regional players come up, and now you're starting to see a lot of local roasters pop up. And I mean, this is something when I started Folly, people were like, hey, like, you know, there's coffee available. If you go, I go, just watch the next 5 years. I guarantee the amount of roasters that will pop up in the next 5 years is going to be pretty crazy. And we're starting to see a lot of that on different scales too, whether it's just the farmer's market roaster or people that are going retail or opening shops. That's an emerging trend I think you see. So I'd say that's kind of where we're at today. And this was the interesting question that Barnaby brought up that we were racking our brains on. In terms of, because he just posed the question to me. He's like, are you trying to go national? And I was like, at the moment, the way I think about it is in a traditional retail sense. So like national distribution, no, because there's so many other ways to sell, and we'll get into that. But the question he posed after that was like, wait, what is the last high-end roaster? What's the most recent high-end roaster to be distributed nationally? And out of those ones we just named, I couldn't think of any other one that you would find on a national scale that's widely popular. And I was curious if you could think of any on a national scale.
Well, it depends on what you mean, because right now we are living in the age of the internet where people can, you know, buy and sell all over the world, really, from any kind of locale. So the first company that popped into my head whenever you said that was Ruby Coffee in Wisconsin. I would definitely consider them nationally distributed, not only because they sell a lot of coffee online all over, but they also have customers all over the U.S. that they have cafes all over the U.S. that are using their coffee. It's really easy for a company in today's world to get coffee into people's hands. So the other, I guess, thinking around that is if there is a coffee drinker, let's say you and I are a 10 out of 10, and somebody that hates coffee with a loving passion is a one.
A zero and a half.
Yeah. So let's say there's a drinker who's in that like 7.5, maybe even 6.5 range where they really enjoy coffee. Maybe they go to a cafe once or more a week. They try to find good coffee when they travel, things like that. So I would think about a nationally distributed company as a company that would be on their radar. Somebody who they kind of know the industry, but they're not in the industry. They're not quite a 100% connoisseur. They're not like, you know, watching James Hoffman on YouTube or anything like that yet.
Or ever know who he is.
Maybe they listen to Folly podcast, though.
Because it's mostly not coffee related, but it's got coffee in the name. There's your casual coffee drinker.
So that person, I don't know that they would know Ruby, but I do know that they would know Stumptown. Yeah. And Intelligentsia and Blue Bottle and Pete's, and have probably sought those places out. Yeah.
So on that vein of thought, here were some kind of key points I pulled from that NCA report. This is from the 2020 report, relatively unaffected by COVID, because I think it came out, I think it was like compiled through March. The coffee consumption up 5% overall since 2015, which is, you know, more or less, I think between 0 and 5%, you see that fluctuation happening over the years. But that's pretty significant when you consider the high percentage of coffee drinkers that that exist. Mm-hmm. And the thing that really stuck out is within that statistic is coffee consumption is up 40% in under 40-year-olds since 2015.
Mm-hmm.
That really jumped off the page. Coffee consumption up 40% mm-hmm. since 2015. A big part of that is cold brew and espresso-based beverages. But that's showing me that the younger drinkers are what's driving specialty coffee. And that's where I go. That's a very positive sign for me in the long-term growth and health of specialty coffee. Now, I will say, in reading this report, specialty coffee is 80 points and above. So this does include your Starbucks of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is a bit skewed, because if Starbucks releases a really popular new, even their cold brew, they launch Nitro Cold Brew, that could be a big part of why this number is going up. But I'm curious, with being a part of Fairwave, what do you see happening in the national roasting, like regional roasters, and then local roasters? Like, so I'll give an example. This is what happened in beer, really similar to what's happening in coffee right now, is you've got your national breweries. So mm-hmm. starting in the late 80s, early 90s, and by the 2000s, they're national, like widely known. So your Sam Adams, your Sierra Nevada, your New Belgium, mm-hmm. Shortly after Stone, and then like Lagunitas exploded when they brought the West Coast IPA to popularity. So you had like three or four major players nationally.
Mm-hmm.
Then you start to see regional breweries like really gain like great distribution and awareness and purchasing from groups of states. Like in Minnesota, that'd be like your Summit or your Surly's of the world.
Right.
Like Shiner Bock down in Texas is very nationally distributed. But if you see the numbers in Texas, you're like, whoa, this is something else down there.
Yeah.
And you see these regional breweries pop up, really dominate in their state and start to get great traction in the following states. But then when you try to push farther than that, the awareness is lower. It's harder to reach those people. And then you just saw small breweries pop up like by the thousands.
Yep.
and then even brew pubs become extremely popular.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious if you see that type of model happening with coffee roasters, or because coffee is different, the online is radically different than the alcohol industry, of kind of how you see the growth of small local roasters and regional roasters and shops happening in the U.S.
Yeah, one of the major differences between coffee and beer is beer has to be distributed. And beer has very different laws depending on the state, how it's distributed. And so, for instance, if I'm in Kansas City, I'm not going to find Surly. And if I'm up here, I'm not going to find much Boulevard or Schlafly from Missouri. Whereas for coffee, I can just jump online, click something, and it's in my mailbox. Or if I'm a cafe, I can do the same thing, and I'm distributing that coffee just through UPS. So the access to coffee is much easier, but that also creates a huge amount of choice. And so the companies that really rise to the top are the companies that really look at marketing and how they can take advantage of different marketing platforms, either that being online or if they're trying to do wholesale, how do they rise to the top within the coffee industry? Some of the things that you have seen that have been very successful, a great example is Onyx Coffee down in Arkansas. They're in the middle of nowhere.
I just went there. It's you drive into Rogers and I'm like, I know it's here, but I still don't know where it is. And you, even as you're pulling up, you're like, this can't be it. It's got the Onyx sign out front. And then you go and you're like, oh, this is like, if you could just dream a coffee setup in terms of service, like serving coffee and roasting, I go, this is it. It's wild that it's in Rogers, Arkansas.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, the first time that I went to Onyx, I was like, I mean, it's beyond what I felt like I could have dreamed up. It's that cool. And they have reached a high level of success by reaching success in competitions, because their coffee has to taste awesome in order to score well, in order for their competitors to do well. And when their competitors all win everything over and over, coffee people take note and they're like, okay, if I want to have the best coffee, I'm probably going to want to call up Onyx. Maybe it's not the best coffee, but I do know that it has been very well vetted. And so all of a sudden they become a national known brand to coffee cafes all over that are wholesale customers. So I'm seeing that. I'm also seeing that, you know, if you think about, let's take the Twin Cities, for instance. Twin Cities, we have a couple of roaster retailers that are just like hometown heroes. I'll call Peace Coffee one of those.
Definitely.
Dogwood, mm-hmm. Spy House, Bootstrap. These are companies that everybody in town will know about if they drink coffee in cafe settings. They roast their own coffee. They have their own cafes, even though Peace no longer has their cafes. Sad, sad day. Those coffee companies are not as well known outside of this area, but they're kind of like the hometown hero. I'm really starting to see that happen in smaller communities. Before, you would have to go to a coastal major city. Then you would have to go to just a major city. But now you can go to like Mankato and find delicious coffee. And there's usually like one company that just holds it down and they are killing it. You can go to
like Duluth. You go up to Duluth Coffee Company and you're like, wow, mm-hmm. they are doing some amazing things up there. And, you know, Duluth is obviously not a small town, but in the grand scheme of cities, you go, it's a small city, but to see a company that's been around for that long doing that, I think you hit that on the head. And I love mm-hmm. that term, the hometown hero. I think that's a really great way to put it.
Yeah. These are companies that are not really interested in the whole online thing as much, but they're interested in saturating their own market and really just taking advantage of growing where they're planted and putting all of their emphasis on being involved in their community. Another good example, if you go even further north, I'm blanking on the name of the little town, but there's a company up there called Fika Coffee.
That's in Lutzen.
In Lutzen, that's right. So these are, I mean, Lutzen is what, 1,000 people at most?
Yeah.
So I was down in a little bitty town called Seymour, Missouri, which is 45 minutes outside of a larger city called Springfield, Missouri. And in Seymour, Missouri, there's the Old Depot Coffee Company. They have their own roaster. It's their own cafe. And if you walk into the cafe, you feel as though you're in a big city third wave shop. If you walk out of the cafe, it is a cross street of a town. That's it, with old buildings, maybe 200 people. But they're killing it in that town of 200 people. So I'm seeing that like crazy.
I think that speaks to a trend that is overall very positive for specialty coffee and the high end specifically. That was one of my concerns coming in about the long-term growth, is the pretentiousness seems to be disappearing within the industry. I think there was a bit of a mirror held up to high-end coffee where it's like, hey, we are turning away people from being excited about this by how they're being treated, by how, not even just treated, but the way they're being spoken to about coffee. It would be like walking into an advanced lecture class on your at your first day of college and having someone try to explain the final end curriculum to you.
Yep.
Versus, I think there's growing awareness for that. And the fact that these companies are having success in areas that you wouldn't traditionally think of specialty coffee succeeding, what that shows to me, I think, is that generally people, when given the option to have better coffee, to have coffee that's roasted more intentionally, and I would say generally lighter so that you're getting less bitterness and more flavor of the actual coffee, I think people generally prefer that. I think the people who don't prefer that are people that have been drinking dark roast for years and years and years, and it's the familiarity and like the bit of the nostalgia of just, this is coffee to me, that when they're presented something else, they're like, this is not for me. But generally, especially when you see this 40% coffee consumption up for people under 40, if they're, let's call it your coffee drinking career. If you're earlier in your coffee drinking career and you're introduced to better coffee, that's what you want moving forward. And the success of these companies in these small towns to me is shows me that. And I experienced this a lot when I was at Sam Adams, which was 2016 was my last year there. Well, mid 2017 is, as I'm driving around Southern Illinois and Eastern Missouri, every small town, you could start to find more and more great coffee. And they tend to do very well because they can very easily say in those towns, we have the best coffee in this area, and it's not even debatable.
Yep.
And the competition aspect is really interesting on the digital side.
Mm-hmm.
We just launched our first, what I consider to be high spend digital campaign, and we've run it for 20 days and it just flopped. Mm. Now, and so we lost a good chunk of change, but it was with some creative that were kind of like, let's put the initial ads out there while we work on the fully produced creative side. So let's test it, and it didn't work. And it made me start to think about the competition on the online side, that you can pretty much plug and play any brand label on most coffee ads. We roast fresh to order, high-end coffee. We source ethically. We're a local, independently owned company.
Yep.
And when you're competing on a national scale, it's not the same as trying to market to someone that's walking into your store or walking through a grocery store where they have a limited amount of options.
Yeah.
And that's a really great point about Onyx, is you go, well, it's not them telling me that it's great coffee. Here's the proof. Here's the evidence. And I've said that about awards in the past, is like, that's why we focus on competing so much when we can, is because it's not us saying, it's like there are people, external sources of validation saying this.
Mm-hmm.
And it will be interesting to see how that landscape of competition changes moving forward too. Because I think as more people become aware of that, you're going to see probably pretty explosive growth on these competitions in the future as people realize the importance of this. I think competitions within coffee are going to go from this fun underground thing that nobody really knows about to hey, if you're not placing well at this, good luck competing digitally on a national scale. And that kind of brings me to my next point within online and different sales channels. So I think that is a pretty good summation of competing digitally, of just direct online sales for your store. We launched on Amazon a year ago. We got deactivated because we don't own the building we're in, so the address didn't match. And so they looked at our bank statement, and the address said these addresses don't, the name doesn't match, so you're deactivated. It took a full year to get back. We're back on as of last
good
week.
Good grief.
But the Amazon, and I mean, I could try to say other online retailers of coffee. You know, there are your subscriptions, which are really popular, but those are very limited to who can actually be involved in that because they just have a limited number of offerings. But Amazon is one that what made me want to go on there is somebody referred to Amazon as a product search engine.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like they're not so much like a retailer, is they're truly where people go to search for products first.
Yep.
Like it, unless you and me and we're 10 out of 10 coffee drinkers and we're going to research before we buy a bag of coffee,
yeah,
or only buy a bag of coffee from people we know and have purchased from before, or at least know their reputation, that 5 to 7 out of 10 person, they're going, hey, I had a great cup of coffee at this local shop. I want to source better coffee. And so they're searching specialty coffee on Amazon, yep, or they're searching like award-winning coffee, or they're searching these things on Amazon. That's going to be, I think, a huge area where people are finding new coffees.
Yep.
And that is kind of where I started thinking about grocery stores the same way, is product discovery, I think, is going to be a big influence on the overall growth of specialty coffee. And so having been in your position across all these different places, what role do you see grocery stores and just any like, megastore retailer playing within the growth of high-end coffee?
Yeah, so if you look at, let's call it marketing or advertising, marketing and advertising is a very, very new construct to humanity. Really, within like the last 100 years have we had strong marketing around the world. And if you look at like...
I got to pause on that. That is a profound thought. I've never... okay, so I know I'm always thinking about beer, but that... So what you just said was extreme... Like marketing is a brand new thing because you never had to tell someone that you're selling it because communities were smaller.
Mm-hmm.
Your business served a service that was needed in that community and you stayed in business because you had a service people needed and there was no one that was going to ship into your...
Yeah.
There's not your UPS that's going to be able to ship these. There's not an Amazon that's going to get it to you in a day. So if you wanted to eat that week, you have to go to the places to eat. If you wanted something to drink, it's the same thing.
Yep.
That is interesting.
And if they traded you a chicken for your coffee or if they traded you cash for your coffee, it didn't really matter either way. You know, so... We live in kind of a brave new world when it comes to how we communicate things and the way that we think about cash and sale and all of these things. So the way that I kind of think about it is less about marketing and more about influence. So when it comes to influence, if we look at how companies are successful, it is kind of about saturation of a person's time. So if a person has a momentary interaction with your brand, you're probably not going to influence them very much. However, if they have an interaction with your brand that kind of catches them by surprise, whether that's walking into a cafe and the taste of your beverage or the barista is just like on point and they're super kind and efficient, or whether the brand has something local about it, like for instance the bridge that you have in your Folly Coffee brand, where somebody recognizes that and it sticks with their mind and connects with them. Maybe they ask their wife to marry them on that bridge or something like that. So then that emotional connection that you have through that moment sticks with a person and you're actually influencing them. Not only are you influencing them to kind of alter their thinking about your brand, but if somebody takes the time to think, their brain actually changes and you're putting a groove in their brain about your company and your product. Now, this can be very manipulative, obviously, and there are a lot of companies out there that, you know, that's their whole point of marketing is manipulation. Or it can just be very personal, you know, and interpersonal. So when it comes to marketing, and when it comes to influence, it's kind of like, how often can I interact with the people that I want to interact with? Who is my audience? Who am I going to connect with in a visceral way to where when they're done with the interaction, I'm going to linger in their mind and get even more basically like FaceTime with them. When it comes to online marketing, that's found in the way of like pop-up ads and videos that kind of capture your attention. You can think about YouTube as being a major influencer? Well, because, you know, you're watching something that's captivating your attention. Maybe you never would have thought in a million years you'll watch whatever it is that you're watching. You had no interest in it at all, but it just happened to pop up after what you did have interest in. So YouTube is excellent at this. They capture your attention and they hold your attention for hour upon hour. We can do that with a brand easiest probably with a cafe, you know, because somebody's in our space.
Right.
We have a captive audience. We can talk with them. We can hold their hand with our coffee. We can prepare the coffee in the best way that we possibly can. So generally speaking, those companies that have some kind of a cafe setting are going to have more interactive time, and therefore their marketing is more personal. It's more subtle. It's not as like in your face. And people become very, this is one of the reasons why people become very attached to brands. I think that since brands didn't really ever exist before, and before brands, it was just your relationships with humans and the human was associated with the products, we still kind of do that. So I always like to say that people don't usually buy your coffee because your coffee is the best. They usually buy your coffee because they feel some kind of connection to you, to your company, to how the company makes them feel. Maybe it's, I want to have the Starbucks cup while I'm walking down Wall Street because I want to be one of everybody else here. It has less about my affection for Starbucks. It has more about my affection for how I'm viewed, things like that. So I like to think about the marketing as just being, how do we build a relationship with a customer? And targeted marketing is what kind of customer is going to enjoy a relationship with me.
And that, I think, plays a lot into why there's such a heavy tendency to lean on the buy local. I think pre-COVID, especially. Sure. COVID, I think, raised a lot of awareness that, hey, buying local isn't just this cute thing to make you feel good. It keeps people in business, and mm-hmm. it keeps these businesses you love alive. But on the emotional side, when you buy something local, it just feels better. Yeah. And you're like, why does it feel better? Well, even if I haven't been to a shop, we don't have a coffee shop, even if I haven't been there, just knowing it's roasted near me is a pretty easy emotional story to make. And then so when it comes to like national distribution or online, that gets harder and harder to do the farther away you get. And especially within coffee, and this is where I think there's a huge separation between beer and coffee, is the spread of flavors in beer is much more widely varied than coffee. So it's way more difficult to differentiate against other brands from just a product standpoint within coffee, because especially in the Twin Cities with Cafe Imports being our backyard, at any given time, you could probably find the same coffee being roasted by three or four people in town.
Yep.
So I heard, on the vein of marketing, I heard something recently that like actually really blew my mind, and it like made me think about things pretty differently, and I've been racking my brain on it for the past week. It was people don't buy wrench, or people don't buy drills. They buy quarter inch holes. And I was like, oh, that makes sense. And then I was like, wait, that's a really good point. No one buys a drill because they go, I want to have a drill. They go, I need quarter inch holes. So I bought a drill that can do quarter inch holes.
Yep.
And then for me, it's like, well, what is the quarter inch hole version of specialty coffee, especially if you're just comparing it to your cheaper alternatives? And that is something I've been racking my brain on that I'm not going to really expound on more because I'm still trying to figure out what that is. And I don't have a great answer for it.
Yeah.
But that is what I think of when I think of marketing. And it that basically like put all these ideas in one concise way to think about it is, you're not marketing to them because of all the things you do. You're marketing to them, and people are buying your coffee because it serves a specific role within their life.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the way you put it, that emotional connection can be directly tied to what role does it play? How much time are you spending thinking about it, whether consciously or not? But to go back to the original question here, grocery store channel, what role do you see grocery store, retail, big box stores, what role do you see them playing? Because I'll just say it up front, a lot of high-end roasters hate grocery. They go, if my coffee's not being consumed fresh off the roast, right, I'm not interested in doing it. But in the same thought of Amazon being a product search engine, you go, if you're not in some places, a lot of people buy their coffee that way. And unless they're not a 10 out of 10 coffee drinker like you and I trying to find every new thing we can, the less time, the better for somebody to make the decision on which coffee they're going to be drinking for the month.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, if you think about it, like right now you're doing marketing through a podcast. Well, not everybody jumps on a podcast with their wallet out, but everybody walks into a grocery store with their wallet out. You know, they're looking for things to buy. And the more
that
places,
right there is all, I just have to pause you on some of these thoughts because I'm like, that is, even online, you're not necessarily hopping exactly on Instagram or Facebook to shop. And so when you're sales conversion, I think would be a perfect term, is like,
yep,
you're just trying to convert someone who's already spending. That's, I had to pause.
That's why
on
we
that
get annoyed whenever advertisements pop up on Facebook and Instagram, because we're not there for that. And we're being told, you should buy this thing. And we're like, no, I just want to look at the sunset that my friend just took.
Yeah, someone just posted a meme on one of our ads that was running, and it was a picture of dog poop, and it said, you paid Facebook to shit on my feed, so I thought I'd do the same to yours. Yeah. And I was like, cool. All right. I was like, that's actually pretty good, though.
Yep. And then whenever we're in shopping mode, we don't want to be bothered with anything else. We want to, you know, focus on the shopping mode. But if you think about a grocery store, I like to think about it kind of like a risk board. How many different places in that store can I occupy with my brand? Well, if you're doing coffee, you want an end cap. You want to have it in the coffee aisle. You want to have the RTD. You want to maybe have your brand in other places to direct people to your coffee
and
brand.
Obviously a hot sauce.
Yeah, hot sauce. Exactly. The more places your brand can be on the shelf, the more interaction and FaceTime you have with the person, the more likely they are to then cognitively connect to your brand, which takes mental time and space away from all the other brands you're competing with and digs that groove into their brain. So then they're more likely to try you after they've seen you on the shelf in every grocery store. And, you know, all, it speaks to them when they see you often. It speaks to them and says, this is something people like. Maybe I should try it too. So I think the grocery is important. I think that coverage is important. And I look at some of these things almost as a loss leader because, you know, obviously grocery stores take a huge margin hit from your business. Amazon certainly does. But there are other things out there too. You know, you can use things like the Good Food Awards and get an award, and then you have coverage from that. You can use things like coffeereview.com. You get coverage from that. You can use things like Tradecraft, where they're distributing tons of really awesome companies, and people that don't really want to spend the time doing the research or don't really want to buy from 10 different companies in the next 10 months can just sign up and get a different company and then refine the way that they like to drink their coffee. Another thing that I'm seeing a lot of companies do is kind of spinning the way that they present their coffees to a broader audience. So I think, you know, going back to what you were talking about earlier, where, you know, it used to be super pretentious. I think we're starting to mature a little out of that adolescent stage. And there are a lot of quote unquote third wave companies that have a single origin dark roast. And that can create such a bridge to a different audience. And so you have more coverage, more of the risk board is covered. So like for instance, in Messenger, which we're, you know, very, very hyper third wave, we have a single origin Thai coffee that goes into second crack and people love it.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't taste good as a light roast. It's where the coffee needs to be. And it allows us to have the opportunity to really connect with Thai growers and help those communities out that otherwise third wave, you know, companies wouldn't be buying from them because coffee's, you know, just kind of plain. So there's a lot of opportunities out there. There are a lot of different ways that companies are exploring hitting more people in more places.
And I think on the grocery store, because this is something that like Jeff and I have spoken about a lot in the past, is like, because at the end of the day, so I've always said that great branding and marketing will get somebody to buy it the first time, but great coffee is what you'll get a lifelong customer.
Follow through.
And how much product differentiation is there if your coffee's been on a shelf, if it's 90 days off roast, if it's 120 days off roast? And that's where I start to push back a little bit on a lot of specialty roasters that say, if you're not drinking this after 2 weeks, it's dead.
Yeah.
First of all, I think that's in general closer to 30 days. And then still even, so when we were direct to stores, we were at 90 days because we didn't have our nitrogen flusher. And then we did some testing. We have that now. And now, so we have a 6-month shelf life at grocery right now. Mm-hmm. And if you taste that coffee next to a freshly roasted 2 weeks off roast per peak perfection freshness, there's a difference.
Yep.
But I think that difference is not as big as roasters make you want to think it is. And yep. That's where I push back a little bit, that I say, am I aware that a coffee 4 months off roast is not the ideal situation? Yes, I absolutely do. But if you were to buy a different coffee at the grocery store, that's, by the way, someone shopping at a grocery store, that's probably their average time off roast.
Exactly.
So their standard
off comparison.
It's comparison. So what I'm saying is that our coffee is going to be much better than that other coffee. I've seen some with shelf life of a year and a year and a half.
Yep.
And it's cheaper, lower grade coffee. It's typically very dark roasted. But that is my big pushback is one of the things that I think will start to drive this, you are seeing, I mean, just since we've started selling in grocery within the Twin Cities, the number of high-end roasters that are now available is incredible. Like the mm-hmm. growth of just the number of high-end companies that are available has skyrocketed. Now the consumer is being driven to that area more because they're seeing all these new exciting brands happening. But that is what I think will be a major driver of growth for specialty coffee are places where it's new introduction to specialty coffee.
Yeah.
And unfortunately with a cafe, unless someone's really local, the people that are coming through are people that are driving out of your way to get your coffee. And so how do you capture the people that they've been in the same routine of going to the same, whatever's the closest coffee shop, I buy at the grocery store, or I go on Amazon to find my coffees. How do you find those people? And that's where I think you're right, is that the pretentiousness towards that side, I think, is also the compromise is there. And I don't mean it in terms of compromise of quality, but the compromise of, like, sometimes this seeking perfection mm-hmm. can get in your way of introducing to more people. And then here's the thing. Hopefully that person drinks that coffee, goes, well, this is way better than what I've been drinking, start to learn a little bit more about coffee, and then they learn that fresher coffee is better too, and they start to be more conscientious in the way they're picking coffees. And then this is the trend in beer that I think is going to happen in coffee, and I'm curious your thoughts on this, because this is already happening with Jeff. I mean, he'll say it himself too. You first find that great cup, and you're like, holy smoke, like, what is this?
Mm-hmm.
And then you go, I want something with more intense flavor. And you're like, what's the craziest thing out there?
Uh-huh.
What are the new processing methods? What variety has the most insane, acidic, like bright, intense, face-punching flavor? And then you get to this point where you're like, oh, but now I just want like a good cup of coffee.
Yep.
And you start to like dial back and you're like, actually, you know what? That thing that I kind of like, oh, this, for me, natural process Ethiopian yogurt chef. A lot of people are like, foo-foo, that is uh-huh. beginner's coffee. I'm like, that's my all-time favorite go-to cup of coffee. And I think once you get to, this happened to me in beer, so it never really happened in coffee, is I was that guy at the party, bringing a mm-hmm. single bottle of room temperature beer, uh-huh. I'm telling people they don't understand what they're drinking, and then I realize, socially, this is not good. And then also, like, who wants to drink beer like that? And then all mm-hmm. of a sudden, it shifts back. And in craft beer, you saw this, triple IPAs, barrel-aged stouts, all these intense, you know, sours that'll rip your face off. Now one of the most popular craft beer styles is light lagers.
Yep.
And if you would have told that to a craft brewer, they'd be like, I will never brew a light lager.
Yeah.
But that light lager is going to be a step up noticeably from your Coors Lights, your Bud Lights of the world. So that's what I think is going to happen in coffee.
Yeah.
And I'm curious if that's been your drinking experience, but Jeff, when he roasts our coffees, I love his thoughtfulness of how he does this, is he says, I want to roast coffees that you want to drink every day.
Mm-hmm.
Like, regardless if they're really bright coffees, I still want to roast it where you get really great balance. And I'm curious your coffee drinking habits as someone who's been in it so long. Like, what coffees are you drinking most on a daily basis? What styles of coffee? And then outside of your own coffee consumption, what types of coffee do you think are really going to become the most popular?
So, yeah, I definitely agree with what you're saying. My analogy for that process is if you think about a little kid and think about how they interact with toys, for instance, if you go to a toy aisle, it's almost all primary colors or like really simplistic shapes, really simplistic straightforward kinds of things. And for a new person, those things are like mind blowing, you know, when they just, they're, when they're told this color you're seeing is red, they're just like, I can't even believe what I'm looking at right now. You know, and that's somebody that's kind of new to coffee. Whenever they taste that Ethiopian natural.
So what you're saying is I'm a child for drinking.
No. I still love those too. They're delicious. Yeah, yeah. And we still love the color red, right?
That's
and it still grabs our attention. That's why a stop sign is red. It still grabs our attention. But there's a maturation that happens. So if you think about somebody who then becomes an artist as an adult, where they can see these subtle nuance changes, for them, a piece of art that they enjoy will probably look either A, boring, or B, confusing to the average person walking on the street. But the artist has the eye for it. You and I have the eye for coffee because we study it in depth. And so for me, when I'm drinking something like a Wash Columbia, I can taste all kinds of things going on because I've really been trained in what to look for. And I've been trained not only in what to look for from like an experiential point of view, but also what kind of work, what kind of factors go into creating those individual flavors, whether it's variety or processing or shipping or roasting or brewing. And I can put all of those things together in my mind, and it creates a completely different level of appreciation and satisfaction. Whereas if I taste like a burnt coffee, it just makes me angry, you know, because I can taste where things went wrong and why things went wrong. So there is that maturation. And I do think that as a society, that maturation will happen as a coffee drinking public. It's just going to be very, very slow, and it's going to be very diffuse. Not every person that is enjoying specialty coffee right now is going to take that path. Some people are going to continue to enjoy what they like. They're all different people. So, you know, I think that it's a spectrum.
I think that's a really great analogy. I know we got to get you out of here, so I'll just wrap it up on this point that the reason what Fairwave is doing sparked this whole thing, because I think this is what's going to happen over the next 5 to 10 years in coffee, similar to what happened in craft beer, is all these things we just talked about. You're going to see people really start to thrive in these categories. You're going to see people thriving in different channels, whether it's a local cafe that's growing number of locations or just following or online presence, whether it's grocery distribution. You're going to see companies kind of start to rise towards the top at a local regional scale. And then that's usually the point where, because the category is growing, you're going to see money start to come into the category, which will result in two things. What Fairwave is doing, which I consider to be the quote unquote right way of, they're doing amazing things. We're going to be able to provide them the resources to continue to do that at a higher level. Mm-hmm. And then you're also going to see the other side of, hey, there's money in specialty coffee now. We're just going to start our own brand and try to pump this out. And you're going to see a lot of brands that I've never heard of start to pop up on your feed and start to be marketed and start to pop up in stores. Folgers already tried it once with their 1850 that they launched, which is, so like 1850 was their high-end Folgers coffee. And I think you're going to start to see that more and more. And then when they try to release those and realize that, oh, people don't want a Folgers high end, then they'll start to buy up small companies if just for the brand. Yep. And so that's going to be the big difference, is you're going to see companies be able to continue what they do. But I think ultimately with coffee, especially, as people, you see this in the beer world, you see this in anything where a brand gets purchased, they're going to be looking for, is this coffee as good or better than what I've been drinking from them?
Yep.
And that will be the long-term growth. But in the short term, that could be a potential risk in the future, but that's where I think it's going. And I get excited by, I think a broad majority of people have never had a truly great cup of coffee.
Yeah.
And I think when you have that, it really does change how you think about coffee, and it makes you want to do that. And that, like, that 40% of coffee growth under 40 years old, that's where I look at that and go, just scratching the surface on the growth of this. And it'll be really interesting when this gets to a point that then business people are starting to look in and be like, where's the opportunity here? And thankfully there's someone like Fairwave doing it, what sounds like the right way. I'm excited for what you're doing there. But that is also something that I think will start to occur too. But the cool thing about coffee is, like you said, the local level, You can have a great business having a coffee shop, roasting your own coffee or sourcing coffee, and have a great, profitable, long-term business built on community.
Yep.
And I think that's going to be another thing you see is the number of roasters is going to dramatically increase, but the size of those roasters is going to continue to decrease of their output. Mm-hmm. So I think the distribution of overall volume is going to be way spread out amongst a lot of local roasters as opposed to having like all the volume be Starbucks. I think that's where those pieces are going to come from, are those large chain roasters. So I know I got to get you out of here. You got a noon meeting.
Well, I'll say one more thing real quick. So I like to think about it as the soul of a company. So if you can join companies together and each company maintains their soul, then that piece of them that the customers that are already buying from them have, that already believe in them, that piece of them is still going to be there. Whereas if a big company comes in and buys out a company and strips the soul, they lose the customer base. So like Topo Chico is a great example of that. The people that loved Topo Chico 5 years ago are now like, oh, they sold out. And you lose that customer base, you lose the soul of the company. And then Topo Chico becomes a trend. And then in another 5 years, it's gone and it's replaced with another trend. The human connection that we have with each other doesn't trend. It lasts. But the marketing campaigns that are all based on what is next, what is hip, what's happening, let's buy that brand, let's put it, you know, across the world. And they strip all the people out of the company. They, you know, put a huge campaign behind it. The soul is no longer there, and it just becomes a trend ready for death in a short amount of time.
I don't know if there's a better way to wrap up this episode than that. You head down to Kansas City next week. I'm sorry to see you go, but I get down to Kansas City a fair amount.
Come on by.
So I know I'll be seeing you down there, and that's I can't right. wait to see the behind the scenes when we get down there. So sad to see you go, but happy to know why.
Thank you so much.
All right. I will end it on that and end it like I do every other episode and say, have a nice day.